Conk, Gainesville's true storytelling podcast, a production of Grow Radio, Gainesville's community internet radio station at growradio.org. The Conk occurs on the first Thursday of the month at Lightning Salvage, 1800 Northeast 23rd Avenue, and we thank Satchel's Pizza and Lightning Salvage for sponsoring and hosting the Conk events. People are asked to tell a true story, 10 minutes or less, based on the month's theme. This month's theme was What's That Sound? Sounds from the Gainesville Music Scene, and was recorded on October 4th, 2018. Part 1 has stories that include meeting and playing music with Tom Petty, finding musical brilliance in unexpected places in the community, playing against the Allman Brothers in a high school battle of the bands, and integration of music in the 1960s and 70s. We have an event here tonight called the Conk. We have it once a month, the first now Thursday of every month, right here at Lightning Salvage. And we have a theme every month. So you all, our audience members, are invited to tell a story on each month's theme. This month is What's That Sound? Music, or excuse me. Yeah. Music. Stories from the Gainesville music scene. There we go. All right, we ask that stories be true, we encourage you not to use any notes, and we'd like them to be less than 10 minutes long. So we've got a list started, it's up here with Bill and Jim, and if you know you have a story.
My name's Charlie Ramirez, and I've been around the Gainesville music scene for about 50 years, I guess, starting in middle school here. And in the 1970s, I was one of the founders of a group called Rose Community, which put on a lot of shows in the university auditorium and put on a little rock festival and the infamous Halloween ball. We started that, too. I don't have anything really long, but I'll tell you a few kind of short anecdotes from back then. Right to the west of here, there's what used to be the Moose Club. And there were a lot of places around town back then that had music that was really geared towards teenagers. So there was a lot of places for teenagers to go and hear music. And the Moose Club was one of them. And there was a band going to play there, and they had a lot of touring bands come through, but they occasionally had local bands too. And there was a band that was scheduled to play there who I'd heard about and I wanted to go see. And they were called the Maundy Quintet. And so I was right up at the edge of the stage, as I always was when I went there. And the band was setting up, and there was a couple guys standing next to me who I didn't know. And one of them leaned over to me and very proudly said to me, pointed to one of the members of the band, and he says, "That's my big brother up there getting ready to play." And then, of course, he introduced himself. He said, "Hi, I'm Tommy Ledden." And then he introduced me to his friend, and he says, "This is my friend, Tom Petty." So that's how I met Tom. Of course, the band, the Maundy Quintet, the big brother that he was talking about was Bernie Ledden, who eventually played in the Flying Burrito Brothers and then in the Eagles. He was one of the founding members of the Eagles. And the other guitar player in that band was Don Felder, who also ended up in the Eagles. Right there within a few feet of each other, there's three people who are now in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. So that's how I met Tom, and we didn't really know each other back then for a while because we went to different schools. This was in junior high school, I think. And he was a year ahead of me, and when we went to GHS, so I didn't really have classes with him, except for once. He was in my PE class once. And I don't know if he was in there for very long. He might have figured out a way to get out of PE. But I remember one time we're dressing out for PE, and he was in the locker next to me. And I look over, and he's putting in his locker a little spray can of mace. And he's putting it in his locker. And I'm like, "Tom, why do you have mace?" And he says, "All the rednecks around here, they want to beat me up because I got long hair. And so I got to carry this to defend myself." Years later, when his first album came out, and he's dressed in this black leather jacket, like bullets across the front, and he has kind of a sheepish grin on his face. And I had to laugh because here's the record company trying to make him look tough. And here in high school, he had to carry the mace around to protect himself from the rednecks. And of course, I had to think, too, that probably a lot of those rednecks probably say today, oh, I was his good buddy in high school, right? Heard him play in a lot of his local bands, his early bands, the Sundowners and the Epics. And then after I graduated from high school, I was living in the dorms at UF. And one day I happened to walk over to the window and I looked down and there was Tom down below. And some of you, if you've read about Tom's life, you know that for a while he worked at the university for physical plant division. And so I looked down and there he was kind of ambling along next to the dorm with a big canvas bag and a strap over his shoulder and a stick with a nail on the end of it. He's going along picking up trash and putting it in the bag. And, you know, and it really kind of affected me. And I thought, well, wow, you know, here's this guy that I know is so talented. And, you know, here he is working, picking up trash. My freshman year, the next year, I ended up moving off campus and I met a guy named Bruce Neron, who was my roommate. And Bruce Neron and I started the Rose Community Center group and we were putting on concerts. And of course, Tom probably played for us in Mudcrutch more often than any other band, and I was really happy to give him as much work as we could. And, you know, thinking back on all that, a couple of obligatory Tom Petty stories. You know, any music scene, there's people who make it, there's people who don't, there's people on the fringes. You know, I'm kind of the guy who stands in the back of the room and listens to bands, and a lot of people just show up and it's kind of background. If you pay attention to music and you're around a music scene for a while, you know that there's always moments that are just magical. Some of you might remember a fellow that was around Gainesville quite a while back. His name was Robert Peterson. I know Gary had played with Robert. And Robert was homeless. He was an alcoholic. He had had some type of brain disease, I think maybe encephalitis or something. He was in pretty rough shape. To put it mildly, Robert didn't really take care of himself too well. He very seldom took a bath. Frankly, he stunk to high heaven most of the time. And he would hang around some of the clubs downtown. Club owners usually wouldn't let him in because he smelled so bad, but sometimes some of the musicians who were playing there, like Gary, would talk a club owner into letting him come in and play with them. And he was really quite a sight. I mean, he never really bathed, and he had stringy long hair and a beard. And he'd be standing on the corner, and he just kind of stood there scratching his head the whole time. And he was usually wearing this filthy shirt, and he would have the collar turned up, and he'd be chewing on the collar. So you picture this guy who's homeless and just, you know, stinks and is standing there like this, chewing on the collar of his shirt and scratching his head, and he'd just stand there like that for hours. And he wasn't ever begging for money or anything, but people, of course, gave him a wide berth because of his appearance and everything. But if you went up and talked to him, he was totally lucid. One of the magical moments that I remember, one time I went into what was Market Street Pub, and which is now Lucy's today. I went in to hear some friends of mine play. There was a couple guys, Britton Cameron and Jack Sizemore, and they were doing their duo thing there that night. And I went in to hear them and came in. They did one of their sets. They took a break, and somebody talked the manager into letting Robert come in. And they had an old upright piano that was up against the back wall, and this was a neglected piano. It had not been tuned in years. Nobody, it was there mostly for looks. Robert came in and sat down at the piano and started to play some jazz, just improv jazz. And at first, nobody's really paying attention. Everybody's talking, the band's on break. But slowly, people start to realize what's going on here. His playing is just brilliant. The normal 15-minute break is over. The band comes back in, and they listen to him play, and they say, "We're not going to stop him." And they sit down and listen, and by that time the whole room is quiet, and they're listening to this guy play music, and he played for probably 45 or 50 minutes. And then he finally left. That was one of the most magical moments I think I've ever experienced, music in Gainesville. And you know, you just feel so privileged to have been in the room when something like that has happened. And if you go to hear live music, please pay attention, because if you do, you'll find some of these magic moments. Of course, Robert was actually an accomplished musician. He had played earlier than that. He was in a group called the McCoys, which had a top 40 hit called Hang On Sloopy. He was in the McCoys with Rick Derringer, who later played with Johnny Winter. He was also in a band called the Candymen, which played in Gainesville when I was a teenager growing up. But the Candymen were the backup band for Roy Orbison when he went on tour. So that's what Robert had done before he became homeless and everything. Sadly, Robert was hit by a car and killed crossing University Avenue some years later. An amazing guy, and you just never know where you're going to find that kind of talent and that kind of magic.
Thank you, Charlie. Next up, we've got Gary.
Good evening. Turn to page 37 in your... Oh, wait, that's... Sunday morning, I'm already... My name's Gary Gordon. Thank you to the folks, Bill and the others, for putting this together. Appreciate Charlie telling that one about Bob Peterson. There's part of that story. I once emceed a Johnny Winter concert in the late 80s. I don't even remember the name of it. It was next to the music hall. Central City? Yeah. Afterwards, Bobby was out front. Johnny came out and stuck a whole wad of bills in Bobby's hand, and they talked for a few minutes because they had played together years before. I grew up in this town and got lucky to see and be part and be inspired quite a bit of the music that went on. My first experience after being handed a guitar by Sid Gerard, who is a psychology professor, and then having a friend in seventh grade who had a guitar and saying, let's play some guitar in the talent show, which really was kind of a disaster, but you got to start someplace, was seeing a band called, Tran Whitley, who now is known as Tran the Piano Man, and Jack Nettles, who is now an attorney, had a band called the Secret Agents, and they were really popular. And they were the first live rock and roll band that I saw after having seen the Beatles on Ed Sullivan. And that was the thing that triggered a lot of us to want to get guitars and form bands. Fortunately, there were not only a lot of teen clubs that were hiring bands, but there were high school dances, junior high dances, and there were the fraternities. And the fraternities were hiring bands all these different weekends, and that was the goal if you were good enough, because that's where the, quote, real money was. This was before the bar scene, and we were all too young to play in the bars anyway, or to learn how to figure out how to get in underage to play in the bars. You know, we all put together our bands, and I was in a series of them with a variety of people, some of whom continued to be professional musicians and some of whom did other things. And one of my favorite memories... There was a talent contest, a battle of the bands, really, at GHS Auditorium that was sponsored by Lifham Music and Sun Music Company in 1969 around Labor Day. And the Allman Brothers was one of the bands that was competing. The Allman Brothers weren't the Allman Brothers then. I mean, that was their name, but nobody really knew who they were. A couple of people had heard of them, sort of. The black drummer came out on stage and set up, and he started playing. And we thought, oh, they're letting a black guy play drums before the next band plays. And then the white drummer set up and started playing along with him. And we thought, oh, the white drummer from the band that's going to play is playing along with this black guy before the band sets up and starts to play. Then the rest of the band sets up, and they start playing Mountain Jam. And we go, holy shit, the black guy's in the band. And we had never seen an integrated band live is 1969. Now, it's hard to imagine for a lot of people, especially maybe the younger people here. We'd seen integrated bands on TV, you know, on the Mike Douglas show or the Ed Sullivan show. You're too young to remember some of that. But we hadn't seen one live. So this was astounding. The Allman Brothers were just fucking amazing. I mean, nobody had seen anything like two drummers and two lead guitar players playing harmony guitar. And they just blew everybody away. We all walked out of there. The guys who were in my band, we ran home. We figured out how to do the harmony leads in the Mountain Jam. And so we could play it at our next gig, which was in Interlochen High School. So we go to Interlochen Gym, and we figure we're going to blow these people away with the Mountain Jam. And we play it, and nobody moves. I mean, they're all just staring at us. And we go, okay, Wipeout. So we play Wipeout, and everybody's on the dance floor dancing. And we say, okay, but someday you're going to really dig this stuff. And it took a while. Okay, the Allman Brothers album came out a couple months later, but it took a while for them to break and then break nationally and the whole thing. I toured with a band that following summer. Just about everybody in Gainesville was in at one point or another. It was called the Styrofoam Soul. And it was an eight or nine piece horn band. I played bass. I was not a bass player. I was a rhythm guitar player with a little bit of lead. But my band had broken up because we were all going away to college. I got a call from them, and they were regular. They worked all the time. And they called up, and they said, do you play bass? I did what any musician would do. I said, yes. And they said, okay, do you have a bass? And I said, yes. And I ran over to Lipham's, and I plunked $60 down. I bought a Kent bass, this awful-looking red bass that was made out of wood from the Santa Maria. Their bass player showed me the bass parts, started touring. And sometimes we would play with another band that would tour. God, I'm trying to remember the name of it. The band that Charlie Stedham was in. Weston Prim. Yeah, Weston Prim. And this was a black band, and Charlie is white, saxophone player, still plays in town. At that time, when he traveled with them, he would wear an Afro wig, paint his face, wear black gloves, and he'd wear black socks because he couldn't be white traveling with them. This is summer 1970. Talking about Tom worrying about the rednecks, this is what it was like. If you left Gainesville, you were out in the territory. So it's a little bit dangerous. Now, I don't know. I went on to be in the Archer Road Band, which had some notoriety in the late 70s. We did an album, some people remember. I went on to manage Hyde and Zeke for several years, then did some more music. I had another career that some people are aware of. Went out to LA, did stuff out there, came back, and I'm doing stuff here. This town has always generated a lot of great music. One of my favorite musical moments, so few people saw. It was this really small, wonderful moment. It happened at about 1:15 in the morning. There was maybe only 10 people. It was at a bar that I don't even remember the name of. It was sort of an open mic night. And these two musicians, Barry Sides and Jane Yee, were playing. And they were playing this tune, Louise, it's an old tune, singing it together. And their harmonies, people don't remember Jane Yee anymore. Some people do. Okay. Just an amazing guitarist, singer, songwriter. She lives out in Washington State now. Barry Sides still plays in town. Their harmony at that moment, at 1:15 in the morning, just gelled on that song so well that everybody, hair on the back of the neck, it was just beautiful. And Charlie's absolutely right. There are moments like that all over town, in each place, but you got to be there, and you got to be listening for them. They don't always happen, but they do.
All right, next up we have Chris.
But my name is Chris Qualman. And I'm very, very happy to be here because I love this topic. This is a topic that is very personal to me. Some of you know me, most of you probably don't, but I used to work in the music business here in Gainesville. I used to run the University of Florida's concert program, Student Government Productions. Some way, I managed to convince whatever I had to do, cajole them to letting me do it 3 years. I was SGP chairman from 1980 to 1983. As I listened to the people talk tonight, you know, Charlie, man, you're fantastic. I loved your stories. It brought back a lot of memories. And Gary, and what I hear is the theme seems to be magical moments. Magical moments, sometimes unexpected, that kind of touch your heart and really tug at your strings. We had a lot of fun, but we did a lot of great things. But I'm going to talk about one magical moment. Some of you may have heard about this, some of you didn't. This little band from Ireland, you might have heard of, called U2, played the University of Florida in the spring of, that's right, I even brought the ad. That's true, it's not a rumor. U2 played the Rathskeller, a room probably maybe a half, two-thirds the size of this room, in May of 1981. And I booked that show, so I thought I'd tell you a little bit about it, because there have been a lot of, I read on these Facebook pages, some promoters even take credit for it. It's like, yeah, I brought that show. Nah, it's really nothing quite so dramatic as that. But it was really kind of amazing what happened. And it's the same four guys. You know, they were, I think, 19, 20 years old at the time they played the Rat. Same four guys are in the band 37 years later. They were booked by an agency. I don't know if they're still booked by them. Premier Talent out of New York City, a major talent agency at the time, was booking Bruce Springsteen, The Who, Tom Petty, Pat Benatar, quite a few others. What we used to do at SGP was we would sometimes book bands through promoters. There were quite a few promoters in the state of Florida, Beach Club, Cellar Door, a bunch of others. But we would also buy talent directly from agencies, and one of those agencies we bought talent from was Premier Talent. And there was a guy named George Quevedo. He was from South America. You know, this is, again, back in the days before cell phones or even fax machines, and we were on a break. It was spring break in the middle of March of 1981. George called me at my parents' home in Lighthouse Point, Florida, and I get this call. My mother says, there's some guy with a South American accent. I can't understand him. He goes, Chris, George, put me a talent. And I go, George, what's going on? He said, there's this band I need you to book, U2. I need this date real bad. I got to have a Thursday night. And I said, George, man, I think I've heard of them, but I don't know if, I'll tell you what, we've got this small little club on campus. It's a cafeteria. We could put him in there. And he goes, okay, I don't care. We paid him $750. Not kidding, $750. It was only 5 weeks away. I mean, we booked the show, like I said, and I think it was the middle or end of March, and the show was booked for May of that year. And in those 5 weeks, that little band blew up. I mean, all of a sudden, it was the number one rock track in America, I Will Follow. WGVL was playing it in constant rotation. It was huge. So that little cafeteria, and by the way, I even found a picture on the internet today of the Rathskeller. You kind of get the idea. It really was a student cafeteria and a beer hall at night with a German motif. Tiny little place. I remember the pinball machines. I think they had pool tables in there at one point. By no means was this the first major concert that ever played the Rat. I'm sure Charlie remembers back in the early 70s before I was a student in 1975. Lynyrd Skynyrd played there. Allman Brothers played there. I'm sure Mudcrutch played there many times. The Rat already had a reputation of being a great little venue to see an intimate, hot show. U2 came. You know, I still get a hard time about this flyer because it's got mistakes on it. For one thing, it says opening act The Invaders, and that wasn't the name of the band. It was a group called The Invasion. And members of that band still, I'm not kidding, they still send me private messages on, you screwed up our ad! No, it was a group called The Invasion, even though the ad says The Invaders. Copy on this ad makes me cringe. It's kind of funny. Guess how much we charged? $2. In May of 1981, you could have seen U2 play the Rat. The copy says, following the chart success of Boomtown Rat, Steve-O and The Clash, come bop out with U2. So you could have, had you been alive back in 1981, I think a lot of you were, you could have bopped out with U2. It was a magical moment. Again, you know, I hear Charlie, I hear Gary and people talking about that. It truly was. This was a young, hungry, hot band. They played this amazing set. I mean, the capacity of that room might have been 250 legally. We probably had statute of limitations has expired. I can't get arrested for this. So it was probably about 500 or 600 at least. But the amazing thing was they ran out of songs to play because the crowd was going berserk. People were just going insane. How good, how amazing they were. The electricity. They opened up with the song, I Will Follow. They came back and played it again. Their fourth encore. You know, Bono says, we run out of songs to play, so I hope you don't mind. We're going to play this again. 4 years after that, in 1985, I graduated, three-year term of duty with SGP. I even booked Gary Gordon. That's another story in and of itself. The quick 15-second version was we did Robert Klein, the comedian, for a free show in the Florida gym. The opening act was running late. I saw Gary in the audience and said, hey, Gary, could you go up and play an opening act? And he did. Grabbed his guitar, went home, and opened up for Robert Klein. That was rock and roll back then. The Rat burned down. 1985, there was a fire, and it was located in a residence hall called Johnson Hall, which is in the Murfree area near Library West, actually very near the Plaza of the Americas. And I remember I got a phone call. I was living in Jacksonville. I was a young lawyer. I graduated law school in 1983, so it's like 1985. And I got a phone call from Bill DeYoung, who used to write for the Gainesville Sun, saying, did you hear the news? The Rat burned down. I'm going, crap, you're kidding. And by that point, U2 was one of the biggest bands in the world. And we talked and reminisced about that. And I remember I said, yeah, a lot of memories went up in smoke there. I think that's how he closed the article. You know, there's a couple of takeaways, you know, for me, you know, from that show. That was by no means the first cool, major, historical show to play the Rathskeller. But it was part of what was back then called new wave music. There was already, you know, this huge movement across the country, and certainly in Gainesville, you had radio stations that were promoting alternative music, new wave music, and I think that show certainly helped carry that wave through Gainesville. And I look at clubs like, you know, Bill had the Covered Dish. I look at clubs like Hardback Cafe and, you know, the Fest event, you know, that goes on to this day. I'd like to think that shows like U2 at the Rat maybe helped carry that wave so that alternative music would still have a fresh, vibrant home here in Gainesville. That show shows that anything can be a venue. Anything. You know, whether it's a student cafeteria, whether it's a high school gym, whether it's a bingo hall, you know, whether it's a pool hall, you're only limited by your own imagination, your own creativity and ingenuity. And I'd like to see more of that guerrilla spirit bringing the music business back to Gainesville. You know, I know Bill's bringing back the Florida Theater, which I think is fantastic. I am so happy to hear that because there's so many great memories of that venue. People ask me a lot, you know, I do get asked, what's going on at the university? Why don't they do as many shows like they used to? And probably a combination of things. Let's face it, students are a heck of a lot smarter than they were then. The academic emphasis is a lot different. I think there's so much of an emphasis on school and studies and careers. There's a lot more regulations. There's a lot more red tape. The industry is different. I'm very encouraged when I see things like Fest. I think this, you know, Tom Petty weekend coming up is fantastic. My takeaway, my suggestion, what I say to young people who want to get into the music business is have that rebel spirit, have that guerrilla attitude. I mean, that's what Charlie and your group was like back in the early 70s. What they did historically in Gainesville just can't be replicated. And I think that's fantastic what the Rose organization did. I did the Halloween ball with Wendy O. Williams. that was something. Unfortunately, it was a great show. It was crazy. It was chaotic. But after that, the university said no more, at least not for a long time. I'm very thrilled to be here. I want to thank, you know, the organization, Bill, and everybody for hosting this event tonight. And let's keep pushing for the music business to grow, expand, and thrive in Gainesville. My name's Chris, and that's my story. Thank you.
Thank you, Chris. It's been really amazing so far to hear about all of this Gainesville music history, so thank you all for sharing.
Thanks for checking out the Conk Podcast. As always, we thank our sponsor, Satchel's Pizza, for allowing us to host the event at Lightning Salvage every month. We also want to remind you that you can find more info about the Conk on our Facebook page, the Conk GNB. You can also check out past Conk podcasts at growradio.org. We hope to see you at an upcoming Conk event in the future.